Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's B-Y-T-E.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, welcome to episode 954 of the Talking Metal Podcast. My name is Mark Striegel. Hope you're doing great and that your week is off to an amazing start. We have two keyboardists on the show, a real rarity here on Talking Metal. I know we had Jordan from Dream Theater on back, I think that was like June or something, right? And now another two keyboardists. And I mean, in the history of this podcast, 954 episodes strong, we've probably had like maybe 6 or 7 keyboardists on or less. I don't even know. I mean, I'd have to go back and do a count, but it hasn't been a lot. I know that. And we've probably had dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of guitar players, you know, and vocalists. And so keyboardists, definitely a rarity here on Talking Metal. But why not have two of them on this episode? We have Adam Wakeman, who is Ozzy Osbourne's keyboardist in the Ozzy Osbourne Band. He's been with Ozzy a while. He's played with all sorts of other people. I mean, the list is amazing. You can check his website out. It's just a laundry list of superstars and talent that he's played with through the years. And of course, he was Black Sabbath's keyboardist. He, with Sabbath, wouldn't be on stage with the four of them, but he was off stage rocking out and doing keyboard and even playing a little guitar when he was touring with Sabbath, backing Tony up. With Ozzy, of course, he is on the stage with Ozzy rocking out, and yeah, great stuff. And anyways, he has a new solo record out that I am really enjoying. We're going to have Adam tell you all about that in a minute. And then after that, we're going to hear from a legendary guy. His name is Mark Stein. He plays with the one and only Vanilla Fudge, a band that I believe once shared the bill with Black Sabbath and Bruce Springsteen. I might have that wrong, but I believe there was an Asbury Park gig back in the day where Bruce's band opened up for those two. Or maybe I'm confusing that, but with something, but I think that's what Carmine, the drummer of Vanilla Fudge, had told me. Carmine a piece had told me. But we're talking with Mark Stein today, and he, again, a great keyboardist with just a legendary band that goes all the way back to the 1960s. Craziness. So we're about to get into our first interview with Adam Wakeman, but before we do that, do you want a Talking Metal t-shirt? I have too many. We usually save these for the people on Patreon, but we're going to do an offer here for the next couple weeks. $10. That's super cheap, barely covering my cost. As a matter of fact, I'm probably not covering my cost, but I got to be honest, I got hundreds of these things. I was sold out. I ordered probably too much and just looking to quickly move some of them. So Talking Metal t-shirt, one of the world's longest running podcasts since 2005. We now have t-shirts that we're doing this one-time offer. This is the cheapest I've ever sold a t-shirt, $10. All sizes currently available, from small to triple X, right? Yeah, so let me know what you need. Big guys, we got your shirts. Little people, we got your shirts. Shirts for everyone, and they're only $10 right now, and I will rush that right out to you. So you can hit me up through PayPal. just go to my website. The website is markstriegel.net. I'll give you the spelling of my name, markstriegel.net. And you'll see a little PayPal button there. You hit that button and just shoot me over 10 bucks. For people in the States only. I'm sorry. I can't send them outside of the States for $10. They're 20 internationally if you want them outside of the United States. But for people in the States, 10 bucks right now. 20 if you're outside of the States, okay? And just hit that PayPal thing, put in your name, address, the shirt size, and we'll get that out to you, okay? You can also support me on Patreon. $5 a month gets you a Talking Metal t-shirt on Patreon. That's anywhere in the world, okay? And the Patreon little tab is also there on markstriegel.net. Thanks for your support, guys. Here's our chat with Adam Wakeman.
Hey, it's Mark Striegel of Talking Metal, and we are welcoming back to the podcast after about a year and a half, Adam Wakeman, best known for his work with Ozzy Osbourne and, of course, Black Sabbath. Adam, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Mom. Thank you for having me back.
Oh, you bet. We spoke last time, I think it was on Skype. It was March 12th, 2020, and you were in Argentina, and a lot happened right after that.
I'm going to blame you. You started everything. That was the last interview I did.
Right. Well, let's talk about that. You were touring with Jethro Tull at that point, right? Am I correct?
That's right. Yeah, Martin Barr was doing a 50th anniversary of Jethro Tull. So Martin's obviously the guitar player right from the beginning with Jethro Tull. And he just called me up and said, do you fancy coming in and doing a few shows? And there was Dee Palmer on keyboards as well. So it was great. It was a great band. It was really enjoyable trip, but unfortunately cut somewhat short.
Right. And you mentioned this in the liner notes to your new album, which we're going to talk about, which is great. It's called A Handful of Memories. It's by the time you hear this, listeners, it will be out and I highly recommend it. But, you know, it was just the beginning of kind of a new phase of your life for what I'm reading in the liner notes, or at least a temporary phase of your life. Because music shut down. I mean, and that is your livelihood, live music specifically. And you really went some different places, it sounds like, in the whole COVID quarantine time. Can you talk a little bit about where you went, you know, personally and professionally for that matter?
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to a lot of musicians who, you know, everyone's been in a kind of same boat, but people talk about it with different degrees of honesty. I've kind of found, you know, some musicians have been okay where, you know, they do a lot of teaching maybe, and then their live music doesn't take so much of their time and generate that much income. For me personally, you know, live music has been a good 80% of my income for quite a number of years now. I have royalties and stuff like that, but that's been coming in. But with record sales the way they are and the way that streaming has affected writers, I'm not going to get on a high horse about it. It's just the way it is. Over the years, over the last 10 years, I would say my balance has gone from 50% royalty income and 50% live income to more like 80% live and 20% royalty income. So as I say, I'm not moaning about it. It's just that's the reality. And you then spend more time away touring. So when something like that suddenly disappears, you've got a very big hole to fill. And I'll be honest, I didn't really feel very enthusiastic about doing, writing seven albums and putting seven albums right. And using that time. Plus, you know, I've got three kids and a mortgage to pay. I need to pay bills. So, lots of people they think that musicians like myself, you know, are minted and loaded and, you know, live in big houses and have fast cars and all the rest of it. So, you know, we're working musicians. We're right. Kind of very fortunate to play with some absolutely incredible people. But, you know, ultimately, it's it's not my name on the ticket. It's, you know, Jethro Tull's name on the ticket, or it's Ozzy's name on the ticket, you know, and I feel very privileged that I'm in that position. However, when that stops, when the touring does stop, you know, there isn't this huge sort of buffer of royalties coming in that can sort of, that can keep you alive for 18 months, 2 years while the world sorts itself out. So basically, I kind of took a slight sidestep into something that I love doing. I've renovated a couple of houses over the years that I've lived in. And a friend of mine said, could you come and give us a hand? I just need some carpentry done. So I did a bit of that. And then somebody needed some other work doing. And I sort of did some of that. And then I ended up being in a place over near Ipswich, renovating a house over there, which I talk about in the liner notes of the album. And it, I just sort of lost interest in not being able to play live. And it just kind of, it's like somebody taking away all your instruments and saying, okay, now what? So as I say, I'm not unhappy about the last couple of years of having to sort of stop music and such. It's been an eye-opening experience, and something that I'm lucky in that I really enjoy construction, building, carpentry, all that stuff is a hobby of mine. So when I'm not touring, I'm generally doing that on my house anyway.
Or, right.
You know, it just became a little bit of a necessity to keep things going. So, so that's kind of what happened to it.
And when you stepped away from the keyboard, you stepped away from the piano, you do eventually come back to it. But I mean, you went a while without playing, but when you do come back to it, from what I'm gathering, you write some just incredibly emotional music that is a part of this new record, A Handful of Memories. I want to talk about some of the specific songs, but do you think stepping away from music for so long, when you came back, there was a sense of creativity that just burst out of you, or did it take a while to kind of pull it out of you? What was it like coming back to the piano for the first time in a while?
I think the biggest problem I had was, if you don't play every day, you get rusty. You know, you're using different muscles in your hands when you're, you know, using a chisel than you are playing a piano. And
right.
By not playing the piano, and I thought about sitting down, I just thought, what's the point? And I said to myself, that's a situation I never wanted to be in. I always said when I was younger, if I stop enjoying playing and performing and writing music, then I'll just do something else. You know, I never wanted to be that guy, that bitter bloke at the end of the bar who's, you know, just always moaning. It's not worth it. Life's way too short to be miserable in what you do. So I thought, by doing that, every time I sat down, I just didn't really want to do it. So I just stopped. And that month became 6 months, which became a year. But then when I did finally sit down, it was a bit of an epiphany of, actually, you know, this feels fresh. It feels new. It feels like I haven't been in this situation before, which, you know, when I was a young man, I just thought music has to be everything. You have to do music full time, 24 hours a day. Otherwise, you're a failure. Now, at the age of 47, I've realized, actually, there's an awful lot more going on that you can do. And make your time as a musician more creative and more kind of, I don't know, emotionally accessible. I feel it's been such an amazing period of not playing music that has made me much more rejuvenated in actually writing and
right.
Hopefully playing some music soon.
Absolutely. And back to the record, A Handful of Memories, the first song I heard, just hauntingly beautiful, The Winter Palace. Let's talk a little bit about that song, how it came about.
Well, the whole album, the concept of the album is basically places. It's a modern classical piano album that has each track has a story of somewhere I've been, either on a tour or with my family or on my own, or somewhere that holds a sort of special memory for me. And each piece is kind of my sort of musical interpretation of my experience of being there. There's, you know, there's places all over the world. The Winter Palace is about St. Petersburg in Russia, where I did my first ever professional concert, which was with my dad when I was, I think, 18 years old, in St. Petersburg. And I've been back quite a few times over the years, but many times with Ozzy and Black Sabbath. And every time I go, it changes in such a rapid way that it's almost unrecognizable from 1995 or whatever, when I was first there. And this piece is just kind of the summary of 25, you know, nearly 30 years of going back and forward to St. Petersburg and the changes and just the kind of, I don't know, that hopefully that song will portray the atmosphere, what I experience every time I go there. And I go running a lot. And when I was, every time I've been there, I've kind of done the same kind of route. And if I'm staying in a different part of town, I'll run to where I've run before. And that way I kind of, there's a familiarity of a country or a city and a country that you kind of, you just see in a slightly different way rather than going to the same restaurant or going, right, you know, whatever. And it's, the run always took me past the Winter Palace. So that was basically the, you know, the obvious name for it.
Right on. And, you know, a song like Sunrise Over LA, I listen to it and I can hear that. I mean, I'm like, wow, yeah, I get it. It could be a sunrise over LA, this music. Does the memory of a sunrise over LA inspire the music or vice versa? Do you come up with an idea of what you want to write about and then it comes out of you? Like, how does the creative process work in putting these places with the music? Is it something you could verbally explain? Maybe not. I don't know.
Well, it varies from track to track, really. Some, you know, none of them I sat down at the piano and said, right, this is going to be about a sunrise in LA, or this is about Iceland or whatever. They were all, I would sit down at a piano and come up with a little part. And then that would lead me to think, oh, this is what I'm looking for LA. I knew I wanted to write a track about LA. I knew I wanted to write a song about New York. I knew I wanted to write a song about Iceland. Wanted to write one about Morocco. So there were specific thoughts going on in my head. And the funny thing was that the job I was doing over in this house renovation was about a 3-hour drive from me. And I would go over on a Monday, right, and I would stay in essentially a building site on an airbed in this house, renovating it. And then drive back at the end of the week or after 10 days or something. So I would have 10 days in this place, a lot of the time on my own. I'd have the time in the car driving and I would be thinking about all these tracks and all these places. You know, even before I'd started writing, I just thought, like, this would be a great idea for an album. And so that time you don't normally get, you know, when you're doing music all the time, you're flying around all over the place and you've got very little time to sit and actually think about the process and how you're going to go about doing it. So that for me I was really grateful of. It was a brilliant way of just kind of getting everything in place before I even sat down and played a note. But Joe, you know, your question was that it kind of starts with a little idea and then that inspires which place I'm thinking about and then it kind of develops from there.
Yeah, you mentioned the song Iceland, which is one of my favorites. It's almost so simple, but yet it's so moving. You have the high note kind of going, and then there's lower stuff happening. Yeah. Just truly creates a vibe. Can you talk maybe a little bit about that song and about Iceland and your experiences with that part of the world?
Yeah. So firstly, the song itself is as you say, it's quite. I wanted to capture the sparseness and the kind of Iceland, for anybody that's not been there, is outside of Reykjavik, you've got an awful lot of empty space and it's kind of sort of barren, goes on forever. You can be on roads for kind of hours and not see another person. It's just, it's such a magical place. I've been there twice now and I can't wait to go back again. I really can't. It's such an inspirational sort of place. And the the track is kind of, there's just one pulsing note pretty much that runs through the whole piece. And that's the kind of, that's what in my mind sums up my time in Iceland, these drives, these incredible drives around this barren country. When I was recording, I mean, all the other tracks I charted out, I wrote out on manuscript paper. So I by the time I got to record them, I was pretty confident of how, you know, each part would be. There's not really much in the way of, ad-libbing through the album. It's like those pieces, if I sat down, I'd pull the charts out and I'd be able to make sure that I can play them, you know, if not identical, very, very similar to how I wanted them to sound on the record. Whereas that track was very much a few notes on a piece of manuscript, and it was, right, turn the lights down and let's just record it. So that was, yeah, I think I only did one version of that song.
Wow. And that was a beautiful song. Beautiful song. And you mentioned recording these songs. This is just piano. This is clean. There's no other musicians with you. It sounds like there aren't even any overdubs or jumps in, you know, it's just straight. You sitting down, hitting record and playing, right?
Exactly. And I wanted it to be as if you were in the room. If you put headphones on, I want you to be in the room with me. And it's about 400-seater auditorium, not far from me here, with a beautiful Steinway Model D grand piano. They have a recording studio set up there. So it was Ben Weston, who was the engineer, was in the studio, which was about, I don't know, 100 yards away out of the auditorium. And I said to him, I just want to use the room mics as the reverb. I want the reverb to sound like you were sat in this auditorium. It just seemed pointless to then put something that wasn't real on something that's so real. You hear the noise of the pedal, of the damper pedal. You hear, you know, the noise of me breathing, I think, on a couple of the tracks. You can just sort of make out in the background. Right. But that's kind of, when you're doing an album that is so exposed, it seems pointless to try and make it sound less exposed, if that makes sense. That was my idea right from the start, and it worked really well, I think, because the room was so nice, and the mics bring the kind of atmosphere from the room. Very weird playing to an empty theater. That's quite weird.
Yeah, it's a great listen. You can pick it up in the States here. It's available on Amazon. I actually just bought pre-ordered the vinyl on Amazon, which I cannot wait to get. But you can also get it through your site, right? What's your site? Can you let us know?
That is a very good question. The best place is to go to adamwakeman.co.uk.
Right on.
And there's a link from there, and that will take you to be able to buy the vinyl or the CD or the links to the streaming services and all that jazz.
Well, I got a couple Aussie questions for you, but first, tell us about the chickens. You bought some chickens?
right at the start of lockdown. Yeah, we bought these chickens. We've had chickens before, but we start off with that enthusiastic kind of, oh, it's great, we've got our own eggs. And then eventually they just shit everywhere and it just makes such a mess. Right. They trash the garden. So we got rid of those ones years and years ago. And then at the start of lockdown, we thought, let's get chickens again. And it would give the kids something to focus on in between the homeschooling. They're great. I'm actually going to gift them to my dad. He's moving house fairly shortly. And he's got a chicken run there. He's always wanted chickens. So I said to him, well, I'll tell you what, moving in present, you can have my 3 chickens.
Right on. Cool. And Jazz Sabbath, the tour was postponed, right? Now it's happening again. It's scheduled.
Jazz Sabbath is happening. Yes. It's we've decided to announce the last date before any of the other dates, for a variety of reasons. So the last date has to be Birmingham for obvious reasons. That's gone. That's just gone on sale now. So that's 26th November 2022. So we're planning ahead. And then there'll be more dates to follow shortly within the next week or so. There'll be other dates up there. So that's going to be exciting. I mean, I'm going to have to really learn to play piano properly.
Right on. And please wish Milton all the best with that. And
I will. Next time I see him, I certainly will.
And you were very involved in a, I think, kind of underrated Aussie record called Scream that was released back in 2010.
Yeah.
It is the only Aussie record, I believe, to feature Gus G. Have you heard from Gus at all? Do you keep in contact with him?
Indeed, yeah. I did a little string arrangement for him. That was probably a couple of years ago. I think he's so prolific with his albums. I think it was his last album, not the most recent album that he's just come out, the one okay. before. And then I spoke to him about a month ago or so, because he was getting frustrated about not playing live and all the rest of it. So we had a bit of a Zoom chat and a chin wag. He's great. He's a great guy. He's such an easy guy to get on with. And it was, you know, it's brilliant that period of time, because it was so, it was sort of so new, you know, certainly for him as well, to come into the Aussie camp, you know. And it's such a huge, you know, a huge machine. It's a, you know, coming from doing the tours, the Firewind tours and stuff that he was doing, you know, it was kind of, I think he coped amazingly well, really, considering coming into yeah. that, you know, he showed no fear. That's for sure.
Right on. And you co-wrote, I think, six songs on that record, the Scream record. Were there any leftover songs? Is there anything still in the vault from those sessions that we haven't heard? Because I've spoken with numerous people through the years, and it does sound like there are numerous Aussie tracks in the vault. I mean, Steve Stevens told me he wrote three songs or something with Aussie that and recorded them, which I've, you know, have still not been released. Are there leftover Adam Wakeman and Ozzy Osbourne songs?
Not the tracks that I got involved. I came to that album quite late in the day. Kevin Cherko had already been working with Ozzy for quite some time. And I came in right at the very end. So the last six songs that I was involved with were pretty much the last six songs that went onto the album. So I don't think there are any that I was involved with that were left over. It was, an interesting story. The very last track, I Love You All, on that album, was the last track that I wrote with Kevin and Ozzy, that was done on the day I was flying home. So I'd been there for 3 weeks, and Kevin was talking to Ozzy and myself, just saying, oh, there's a, you know, it'd be really cool to do this kind of, this track at the end of the album, which kind of, you know, uses what you say. He's always, you know, ended shows by saying, I love right. you all, or whatever, yeah. you know. And Kevin asked me if I had any sort of ideas, and I was kind of out of all the ideas that I'd played. We'd gone with the ones that were any good, and anything that wasn't any good, we kind of went, no, let's not bother with that. And I had this little idea on an acoustic guitar that I recorded on a bus on a tour bus in Boston on one of the early Black Sabbath tours. And I just named it on my iTunes, the Boston Sprangler, which would remind me of that it was the track that I wrote in Boston.
Right, right.
And it was just that guitar, that opening guitar sequence. And I was going through the iTunes, and I was just playing stuff to Kevin and Ozzy. And when that came up, they both went, yeah, that, play that. So I grabbed an acoustic and then ended up simplifying the version that I'd recorded, because it was a little bit, you know, it sort of changed chord every bar forever, you know. It was one of those sort of pieces,
right? Right.
So we kind of revamped that, and that became that tune. And then I like lunchtime came, and I went and got the plane home.
Right. Wow. Cool. And anything going on with Headspace or Wilson and Wakeman? Any updates on?
Well, we're trying to work out what is going on, like everybody else, because shows are getting cancelled and people are getting COVID, and obviously, you know, there's an uncertainty. We've got dates in with we're doing a festival over here with Headspace in the UK in April, I think, or might be okay. May. We're booked on Cruise to the Edge for the leaving Florida in March or April. Might be May as well, actually.
Right.
I can't remember. I think it's May. But again, it's a difficult one, because nobody really knows if, you know, what the transportation side of things are going to be getting over to America. I know it's opened up now for vaccinated travellers, so that's a good thing. But Wilson and myself, we are heading off. We've got some shows starting next week, and then we play pretty much up till Christmas over in Europe. And just fingers crossed. I had COVID a couple of weeks ago, so I'm kind of, I feel a little bit relieved in one way, in that I'm fully recovered and absolutely fine. It was relatively mild considering, you know, what a lot of other people have gone through. But Damien hasn't had it yet. So there's that kind of just that little cloud that follows you thinking, well, you know, if he gets it and he goes down, then obviously the tour's off. So,
right.
But I think that's the same for everybody. You know, it just is what it is. And we've got to try and get through it, as navigate it as sort of safely as we can, really.
Cool. Well, I'm glad it was a mild case, Adam, and glad you're feeling better. Did you lose the sense of smell and taste and all that?
You know, it was the weirdest thing. I mean, I basically had like a blinding headache for about 2 weeks, and was very tired and lethargic. And I think the taste and smell is such a weird thing, because it just takes the fun out of eating. You forget how kind of enjoyable eating is until you start getting your taste back. And I was checking myself most days by sniffing a bottle of Ribena. Do you have Ribena in
America? I don't know what that is.
Ribena is like a really strong cordial blackcurrant drink that you add water to. It's like you have it as a kid, basically, but it's incredibly strong. So every morning I'd kind of have a quick sniff of the bottle, see if I could smell anything. It was like, nope, still nothing. It's just started to return. I had a coffee today and I could taste that. So that's a good start. I can get back to my caffeine intake.
Right on, right on. Cool. And again, the new record, A Handful of Memories by Adam Wakeman. It is out now, up on all the streaming services. You can get the physical copy at Adam's website. It's also available on Amazon. And we hope to get you back in this country soon, making some music for us in the live setting, Adam.
Oh, let's hope so, Mark. I can't wait. My dad's actually just come back. I spoke to him early. He's been out doing shows across America. And
was it the Grumpy Old Man tour or something like that?
Even grumpier than the last Grumpy Old Man. So yeah, he's basically morphed into that character, and he really is the Grumpy Old Man. So he's he doesn't have to try too hard.
Right on. You know, I never knew your dad played piano on the with Cat Stevens. He plays on what song is it? A couple songs.
Oh, right? Morning is Broken.
Oh, right? I never knew that was broken. Rick Wakeman. I was like, oh my God, I just recently was looking at your dad's set list actually, and he had played that. Yeah. And I was like, wow, that's such an iconic song.
You know, the funniest story, I don't know if you got time for this, but he tells this brilliant story about when he got the session to do that. Because back in the day, he was doing 3-4 sessions a day, 7 days a week, you know, around London in the 60s. And it was just late 60s. He was in and out of studios the whole time. And he went to that session. And I can't remember the producer, but the producer said, right, okay, so it's the hymn Morning is Broken. And my dad played it through, and it was 1 minute long or something. It was like a verse and a kind of chorus. And they said, oh, well, just repeat the first verse. So he repeated the first verse. And then they said, okay, that's still only 1 minute, 48 seconds. It needs to be longer. Can you do a bit of twiddly twiddly in between the two verses? So he did a bit of twiddly twiddly, and they're like, 2 minutes, 20. Can you make it a bit longer? And he was like, key change? So put a key change in it.
Yeah.
Bit more twiddly twiddly. And that was it. And he was like, he started off with, you know, a very sort of basic, 1 minute hymn and made it into the kind of the arrangement that it was. And he would always tell this joke about how, Cat Stevens made millions of pounds out of it, and he got £6 for the session.
Right, yeah. And sounds like he practically wrote the song.
Well, pretty much. It's certainly the arrangement. And anyway, he was telling this story, and Cat Stevens got in touch with him, or Yusuf Islam, as he is now, got in touch with him and just said, I heard an interview on the radio that you did, Rick, and it said that... that you only got a £6 fee for the recording. And if you want more money, I can give you some of the money from the royalties. Wow. And my dad said, don't worry about that. He said, I've had more fun out of the story than any payment could bring. So
it's
the one really nice thing to do. It's the story got back to him, you know?
Yeah. Wow. That's great. Great story. Adam, as always, so great speaking with you. And all the best to you and your family. And we'll talk soon, I'm sure.
Brilliant. Thanks again, Mark. See you soon.
All right. Big thanks to Adam for joining me. Let's now get ready for our interview with Mark Stein of the Vanilla Fudge, a band that we've spoken with Vince and Carmine about through the years. And today we're going to talk to Mark primarily about his new solo record, but also, you know, some of his amazing history, not just with the Fudge. Actually, we don't even get into too much of the history he has with the legendary band, the Vanilla Fudge. We mostly talk about his solo record and him playing with Alice Cooper and Tommy Bolin and some other stuff. And before we hear from Mark, I do want to mention that his band, the Vanilla Fudge, is about to release remastered versions of their version of Led Zeppelin's Ramble On. I guess, did I say remastered versions? I think it's one version. A remastered version of their version of Led Zeppelin's Ramble On. Now, Led Zeppelin is a band that opened for the Fudge back in the day, and Carmine has told us that they, you know, used to coach Robert Plant, and that John Bonham ended up getting a bigger bass drum because of Carmine. That's Carmine's version of events, which could very well be true. You know, I'm not one to doubt Mr. Carmine Appice. And speaking of Carmine Appice, let's talk to his bandmate right now from the band, Vanilla Fudge. And Mark has a solo record out he's going to tell us about. So here we go. Mark Stein on Talking Metal.
Hey, it's Mark Striegel, and we have a legendary performer on this episode of Talking Metal. His name is Mark Stein, best known for his work with Vanilla Fudge. And it's very cool to talk with you, Mark, because on this particular episode of Talking Metal, we actually have two keyboardists, and we don't get to talk to a lot of keyboardists. I just spoke with Adam Wakeman from Ozzy Osbourne's band, and now we have you, Mark Stein. So welcome to the show.
Well, it's great to be here, man. How's everything going out there? And Zoom land.
Yeah, it's going good, man. And I'm psyched because we have you on the show, number one. And number two, you got a new record out. It's a solo record. And I believe it's your first solo record ever. Is that correct?
Well, it's my first solo album on a label.
Okay. Okay.
I put out different editions, you know, over the decades, but self-published kind of stuff. But yeah, it's on Deco Entertainment and a great team of guys, and they're doing a wonderful job and give me great coverage. And the record will be out pretty soon, November 26th. It's called There's a Light. And yeah, you might say it's the best of Mark Stein, because there's a song that I wrote called We Are One, which I wrote about 6 weeks after the pandemic, which is the first single, which was released about a month ago. I don't know if you've seen the video.
Absolutely,
or heard the song.
I did. Yes, I've seen the video and heard the song. Great song, emotionally moving. And in some ways, when I heard that before I heard the rest of the record, I was like, oh, okay, this might be a softer side of Mark. But then when I heard the record, I mean, there's some real rocking tunes on there too, like Racism, some great guitar work on We Are Survivors. Good rocking stuff there. But let's start with the first single, I guess, off the record, We Are One. Talk about how that came about. And you said that going into the pandemic, you wrote that pretty early on. Can you talk about some of the emotions you were feeling that inspired that song at that time?
Yeah, well, you know, if you recall, when we were maybe 5 or 6 weeks into it, when it was officially a pandemic, you know, it was like everybody was, most people in a state of disbelief. I mean, is this really happening to mankind? Is this, am I watching a science fiction movie here or what, you know?
Right.
But it was really true. It was really happening. And to see what was going on to those poor folks over in Italy, so many people, the chaos and the people dying and getting sick and spreading over, you know, the United States and New York and, you know, the whole globe, it was pretty hard to bear, you know, and people were just getting so paranoid to, you know, to shake hands with your own neighbor or hug their children or what's the plan to survive. That's I just happened to sit down at the piano, and this whole thing came right through me. I started singing and playing the song, and I said, "Wow, this is coming," you know. And I just kept going with it, and I felt like this karmic connection, because it started off, you know, here we are battening down the hatches.
Right on.
Afraid to shake our neighbor's hand or touch, hug our children. What's the plan to survive? And then the line hit, you know, we've had so many chances to spread some love and human kindness all of our lives. But, you know, after world wars and, you know, economic disasters and hurricanes and 9/11 and you name it, you know, we're still divided on so many fronts, you know. And to me, it's all about loving one another. And it's very disappointing to see, you know, what's going on in this country on different levels. But anyway, the song came to me, and I thought it was kind of like a karmic event, the pandemic, you know.
Yeah.
But then it goes on to talk about hope and how we're going to love one another more than ever before once this is behind us. And that's what was behind the song, you know. So I know I had a cool song, and I wanted to do it like an old Elton John kind of song, you know, with the grand piano and like a Paul Buckmaster kind of string arrangement, you know.
Yeah.
In those early days. And I called my buddy Alan Hewitt, who's also a great keyboard player from the Moody Blues, you know, and John Lodge, you know.
Right on.
So he said, "Well, come over to my place, man. I got a cool, you know, we'll lay down something." And I went over and laid down a piano track along with a click track. And then suddenly he got like super busy, so he couldn't continue the project. So I found somebody close to my house, a fellow by the name of Joey Z, who has a place called Blue Porch Media. So anyway, long story short, we sent the files over there. I did all the lead and all the backing vocals. I multi-tracked all my own vocals on it, and I put the whole string arrangement on it from the sample, you know, synthesizer machine that I have, one of the Korgs. Came out great, and I was really excited about it. But now I needed drums and bass, guitar. And so I called my buddy Stevie D. Akutis over at the Sound Spot in New Jersey, who's worked on a bunch of my solo tracks and Manolo Fudge tracks and his own tracks. And, you know, he really dug it. When he had time, he, you know, he put a guitar track on it, a little acoustic. And he actually, I said, "Why don't you put a bass track down to it?" So, yeah, you know, you got a drum program. Maybe we don't have to hassle with anything. So he put a drum program on it, and just came up with this whole production. It's just two people on that track, and we were really excited about it. And it sounds really cool, you know, and people are loving it. And, you know, that's how it came about. So
now, is he handling the guitar on the rest of the album too, or just that song?
No, Stevie D is playing guitar on a bunch of tracks.
Yeah, because there's some great guitar work. Yeah, there's some great guitar
work. Yeah, he played some cool guitar on Racism and All Lives Matter. Yeah, yeah, I mean, all the credits are on the album. It's very precise.
Cool.
A lot of cool players on there too.
And a lot of cool songs. Let's talk about the cover that you do, a Temptations cover. Can you talk a little bit about that? And just wondering how that fits in, because, you know, the album, there's definitely some social commentary there, but this is a very strong song when it comes to social commentary. Do you feel like the lyrics apply to where we are now in time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when my manager, Bruce Pilato, we started putting tracks together, you know, for an album, he said, "Well, man, Ball of Confusion. I love this track." I said, "Yeah, I produced it for a movie called Rock on the Wall," which was out a number of years ago. The theme of the movie was rock's influence on the fall of the Berlin Wall and communism.
Oh, okay.
You know, but if you listen to the lyrics, even though it was done by the Temps in the early 70s, it's so relative to what's going on today. The world is a ball of confusion. I mean, I'd say the lion's share of the lyrics are relative to today. And we just finished this killer video. It'll be out Monday. Where do you see this video, man? It's really, really exciting. Pretty cool. Scary. So that'll be out Monday with the release of Ball of Confusion with the video.
Now, when you say scary, in what way?
Well, I mean, it covers a lot of the madness that went on, you know, up in the Northwest with the burning down of the cities, all the confusion, all the, you know, the racial confusion, the, you know, all the issues that have been you know, that have been plaguing all of us for the last few years. Political issues, economic issues, that's all put together in a really cool format. And so far, the pre-comments on it are like, wow, you know? So,
very cool. Yeah. And let's talk about a few of the other songs before we jump into some of your incredible history. The song Racism, again, some great guitar playing on this, but can you talk a little bit about the message behind this song?
I was watching a news show one morning with my wife, Patty, and there was a, excuse me, there was some footage of, excuse me, I got a little frog on here.
Oh, that's all right. I can clean it up.
Forgive me. I was watching some footage of a black kid and a white kid, must have been like 5 years old, on their way to school, you know, and they were walking down the street and hugging one another, kissing one another, happy together. And I'm saying, Patty, look at the joy in these two kids. I said, why does this have to change when they get older? You know, racism is certainly a form of prevalence on it in our society, you know. And I started getting this idea. I went over to the keyboards and, you know, I came out, would ever see a black child walking with a white child on their way to school, smiling at each other like a sister and a brother, laughing at the grown-up fools, because they're way too young. Their life has just begun to follow the golden rule of hating one another because their skin's a different colors growing up in a world so cruel, you know. And it goes on, you know, to talk about their mommies and daddies, they could never get along throughout history, the venom so strong. Shame on humanity for letting it get away from 200 years ago to this day. And it goes on, racism. How did it ever start? Racism, pulling our world apart. Racism poisons the human heart. And it goes on, I'm not gonna give away all the lyrics. And I wrote this really cool, heavy R&B rock track to it. And the middle section, I call the chase scene. It's like an instrumental chase scene. It's almost like an ELP type of, yeah, type of thing going on with multi keyboards and Stevie D on guitar. And yeah, I mean, I think it's an exciting track, and that'll be on the album, you know. And it's just all part of the twine of the album, you know. It's right. How the world was, how it is now, and hope for the future, and covers love and patriotism and all kinds of issues that we're facing.
Right on. And we are talking with Mark Stein about the new album, There's a Light, out November 26th. And before we move into your history, just a couple more questions about the record. We have We Are Survivors, which again, is just some in-your-face guitar playing on that song. When you say We Are Survivors, what's the main message behind that?
Well, the original message was, it was written for the folks that were having a tough time behind the Iron Curtain. Mm. All right.
Okay.
So it was really originally written, again, that I wrote the lyrics, you know, that was relevant to that. We Are Survivors, you know. I forgot the words to it, but if you listen to it, you know, we have a history of sainthood. And my mind's kind of, yeah, I mean, it was relative to We Are Survivors because the people survived communism and just got through it and became free, you know?
Right on.
That's really what it's about. Should have had a lyric sheet in front of me because, yeah.
Absolutely. We're talking with Mark Stein. His new record is There's a Light, out November 26th. Let's just quickly dip into your incredible history. I mean, we all know Vanilla Fudge, and I do want an update on Vanilla Fudge before we let you go. But talk to me about Tommy Bolin. You did work with him, and I don't know if a lot of people know that. And of course, Tommy Bolin put out some incredible solo records and was on kind of a cult classic, I'd call it, Deep Purple record, if you will. But let's hear about your work with Tommy.
Well, I had moved out to the LA area around 1973 or four, and I was just writing songs maybe a year and a half, 2 years after Vanilla Fudge had first split up. And, you know, I was putting together a solo band. And Reggie McBride, who was the bass player with Stevie Wonder, joined forces with me. along with some other cool folks. And
wow,
he said, I got a call from this guy, from Tommy Bolin's manager. Tommy Bolin was the hottest guitar, you know, virtuoso in 1974, 1975 in LA at that time, or in the business. He was really incredible with the teaser album.
So was this cool. After Deep Purple or before Deep Purple? I know he was in James Gang too. I think, you know, the yeah. Joe Walsh's well, band after Joe Walsh.
Yeah, this was after Deep Purple. He had left Deep Purple because he wanted to pursue a solo career and he wanted to put a solo band together. So the timing was, while I was putting my solo band together, Reggie got a call to go down and play with Tommy. And he called me and said, look, Mark, I'm going to play with Tommy because this is going to be a really great opportunity for me. I said, hey, dude, why don't you ask Tommy, tell Tommy I want to come down and play too, you know? So that's how that happened. I went down to SIR in LA and Tommy was a fan of mine in the Fudge. So I went down and we started jamming together and it was magic, man. He asked me to join forces with them. And then like Michael Walden from the Mahavishnu Orchestra on drums, he got him in the band and he was amazing, a young Narda. And there was also Norma Jean Bell, who was fresh out of Frank Zappa's band on sax and vocals. And she was just killer. Her and Tommy was so great on stage. So there was the band, man, the first configuration of the Tommy Bolin band. It was a mixture of soul, you know, progressive rock, fusion, blues. And what a band it was, man. If anybody saw that Tommy Bolin band, that first band, we played the Roxy in LA, man, in 75. I mean, the place was wall to wall and it was so much excitement. What a great night that was. And Tommy was, he was like so cool because he wanted everybody to shine, you know?
Right.
You know, he had Narda do a song called Delightful that he wrote. He had me do a song called I Fell in Love, which was like Ray Charles inspired blues tune. And it was so cool because I did it on the grand piano and Tommy and Norman and Reggie, he called themselves the Sniffettes, like the Raylettes. He said, we're the Sniffettes, singing all like the background parts. And it was a bar burner, man. People loved it, you know?
Cool.
But of course, Tommy had his demons that he couldn't overcome, you know?
Yeah.
No matter who tried to get him straight, it just didn't work, man. He just couldn't overcome it. So, I had left the band before that fateful tour because communication was getting almost impossible. And I thought it was time to leave. And we became really close before that too. So it was kind of tough, but sure enough, on that tour, he lost his life one morning after he opened for Jeff Beck in Miami. I guess it was 76.
Yeah.
He was gone. He was only 25 years old. I mean, I can't imagine how amazing he would have been. I mean, all these years later, because he was such a great songwriter, not just a great guitar player and a great performer. The bands he would have been in and the solo albums he would have put out and the songs he would have written. It's just really, it was really a tragic loss. So
absolutely.
That's the name of that tune, man, you know?
Wow. Thank you for sharing that, by the way. And yeah. Alice Cooper, you did some work with him. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I was asked to join the Welcome to My Nightmare tour in the Southern Hemisphere, which was Australia and New Zealand. It was like way back in 77. And it was a pretty eventful situation because at the time it was the biggest grossing tour of all time in the in the Southern Hemisphere. And what was really cool about it, like ABBA was also touring the country, and at that time they were probably the biggest selling band in the world, you know. And on one side of the street you'd have the ABBA fans, on the other side you'd have the Alice Cooper fans with all the posters, and you look outside the hotel and it was all this madness going on.
Wow.
It was really fun. So we played to sell out arenas and stadiums all over the major cities in Australia. I think we had 50,000 people in New Zealand. It's like this one giant picture where we look like little insects. against all the people outside in the fields, you know. So that was a, yeah, it was a good experience.
Wow,
and
cool.
A good credit. So, yeah.
Very cool. And you also had, what, if at least 2-3 years with Dave Mason, you worked with him?
Well, yeah, I was with David probably about 3.5 to 4 years. And
wow, okay.
That's probably one of the most fun times I ever had in this music business. David was so, we also became really good friends. It was interesting because at the time I was being influenced by, you know, like the Blow by Blow and the Wired album by Jeff Beck and Mahavishnu Orchestra. So I was getting into the mood. I wanted to be like Jan Hammer. I wanted to get away from the Hammond and get into more advanced keyboard playing, synthesizers and all. I was really getting into it. I put together a fusion rock tape and I was shopping it. And a great guitar player by the name of Les Dudek had heard my tape, you know, in LA. And he was part of a management team that managed Ronnie Wood and Dave Mason and himself and the late, great Mike Finnegan, who just passed recently too, and Jim Krieger, guitar player, songwriter. But so he loved what I was doing and he played it for his manager, Jason. And Jason got all excited. He invited me over to his house and he said, play me one of your songs, you know? So I played him a song called Life is a Ladder that I had written, you know, it's kind of like a pop tune, you know? And he flipped out. He says, man, I'm going to get you a solo deal. He picked up the phone and he calls up the head of A&R in LA at Columbia. And just like that, I got a solo deal just from a phone call.
Wow.
And not only that, he said, Dave Mason is looking for a keyboard player and I want you to go join forces with him while I'm putting this deal together. So I went over to Dave's villa, this fantastic villa, Mariposa de Oro, fabulous place in the Malibu Hills. And I met David and we got on great together and we talked for a while. And, you know, he was a Fudge fan from the past and actually came to see us in England in the late 60s. We played with Traffic on a bill too back then. So anyway, he invited me over to the studio to the record plant and it was like magic, man. I started playing some organ and synthesizers, and I ended up playing most of the keyboards on an album called Mariposa de Oro, which I think is a really cool record. And that was it. And I started hanging and touring with him and for the next 3-4 years. It was a great relationship. We just had a blast, man. We played all over the world. We toured a lot. We had a lot of fun.
Wow.
And what was cool about it was I got into that whole LA scene, you know, with the Stephen Stills crowd and the Poco crowd and, you know, Ryan O'Neill and Farrah Fawcett and Dan Haggerty, Grizzly Adams used to always come over to his place. We used to hang out all the time. And it was like an everyday thing. And all these movie stars and everywhere cool. We played, everybody, we were selling out everywhere in LA. And I mean, it was just really fun. It was really, really fun. We had some great bands, man. We rocked the house. And, you know, I have fond memories of that.
Right on. Great stuff, Mark. And thank you for sharing your history with us. Before I let you go, and we are running out of time, just a quick update on the Vanilla Fudge, because I know you guys are doing gigs and there's stuff going on. You did something really cool recently, which was release a cover by the Supremes. Of course, you guys... the thing that really brought you to the forefront and Ed Sullivan and all that stuff back in the day was your cover of You Keep Me Hanging On, which to this day in movies like, what was Quentin Tarantino's last movie? Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you know, that scene.
Yeah, thank you for that wonderful sync license fee too. That helped.
Yeah. that is an intense scene in that movie. But anyways, you guys covered before Tim left us, the late Tim Bogart, you were able to, do another Supremes cover, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Talk about that, please.
Stop in the Name of Love. Yeah, yeah. It's interesting because the label Golden Robot out of Australia, you know, wanted us to do another Supremes song because we were known for, you know, having success with Motown songs. And so anyway, I was thinking about it and I came up with this. This template for an arrangement for the tune. And I presented it to the band while we were on tour. in November of 19, before the pandemic, you know,
right.
4 months before. So we were at TKL Studios, you know, my buddy's studio, Tom Merlin, in Hohokus, New Jersey. And we laid down some stuff, and we never finished it. So before we got a chance to get moving on it again a few months later, we got hit with the pandemic. So everything was, you know, put on hold for probably 2 years, you know. Terrible time for musicians and most people in the service industry. So let's fast forward. You know, Carmine had put together a drum studio in his house in Florida, and there was a lot of leakage on the tracks, so to speak. So he had put a whole new drum track on it at his place and sent the tracks over to Pat Reagan, who's a really cool producer and, you know, rock mixer out in L.A. And while he was out there with Pat Carmine, he managed to get Tim, who was very, very ill. Tim managed to get enough spunk together to put a track on there. Jorgen, the bass player with Government Mule, had some kind of a studio set up. So he helped him get to his place. And he overdubbed a really cool bass track that was probably the last of the energy he had, man. And
wow.
So Stop in the Name of Love has all four original members on it. And it was probably released a couple of months ago. And actually, it's pretty cool, you know. It wasn't exactly 100% how I wanted it to come out. But you know what? It's pretty damn good. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I think it sounds great, man.
I appreciate it. And we're playing it live in the new show now too, actually. So it's getting a really cool response. But so that's how that came about. And rest in peace, my brother, Timmy Bogart, you know, he passed in January.
And of course, Vanilla Fudge continues on. You guys are playing shows. It's you, it's Carmine, it's Vince, Benny, right? And who else? Who's in Tim's place now?
Pete Bremmy is a bass player. Actually, he's been with the band 10, 11 years now, because Tim actually retired about 11 years ago from touring. Yeah. So Pete Bremmy does a great job, plays all Tim's lines, and kind of add a little bit of himself on there, and got some good energy on stage. He sings all the high harmonies. And we're rocking, man, you know, for a bunch of young buzzards.
<You know? laughs> Right on. Mark, we're going to have to end it there. I do appreciate your time. I appreciate the new music, and I appreciate all the great old stories from the classic days back, Alice Cooper, Dave Mason, and Tommy Bolin. Great stuff. I mean, we could go on and on. I'd love to hear the Zeppelin stories at some point, having Zeppelin open up for Vanilla Fudge, but we are out of time for today. Okay. But there is a book out. Tell us about that real quick before we go.
Yeah, it's called You Keep Me Hanging On, The Raging Story of Rock Music's Golden Age. And it's probably over five decades of how rock evolved from the early days up to, the 2000s. And it's written in the third person. It's a biography. It's like a You Are There. Behind the scenes stories about, how we toured with Hendrix, how Vanilla Fudge, what our place was in progressive rock, what relevance it was, and the dawn of Led Zeppelin when they actually opened for us when they first came out.
Yeah.
How I saw that evolve. And, it just goes on and on, because we were at the center of the pop music universe back in the late 60s. And it's been critically acclaimed. It's interviews from Robbie Krieger, from Billy Joel, from Sid Bernstein, who brought the Beatles to America. Lots of interviews, Glenn Hughes, all kinds of stuff. Paul Schaefer. So it's really cool. And hope you pick up a copy. Mark-Stein.com. You get a signed numbered copy, or if you want to go to Amazon, you can always get it there. Or come to our shows, because we're selling it at the shows.
You got it, man. Thank you for your time, Mark. We appreciate it. And thank you for the new music. We're going to have that linked in the show notes on today's episode, guys. If it is after November 26th, when you're hearing this, the music is out. Go stream it, go buy it, and check it out. Thank you, Mark.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, dude. We'll be right back.
All right, guys, that does it for today. I know I didn't read the list of all the patrons. I usually do that. I'm tired. And yeah, doesn't mean I don't love you guys. Love the people who support me on Patreon. I encourage everyone to do it. And again, my website is markstriegel.net. Follow me on Twitter @TalkingMetal. Follow me on Instagram @TalkingMetal. And some stuff going on behind the scenes, which I will hopefully reveal to you guys soon. Kind of interesting. I don't know how it's going to turn out yet, but I got a good feeling about it. So we'll leave it at that. All right, guys, have a great week. Talk to you soon.